For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks demand wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Years ago, a church in New England observed its 300th anniversary. A well-starched congregation set about to celebrate in fine style. They scheduled special speakers, they had a big party, and as you can expect, a few of them dug into their own history. Now, it's amazing what you can discover when you start poking around in your own archives. And according to the local historian of that church, the sanctuary had extensive repairs in the year 1831. After the building was shored up, they added a steeple with a bell, and then something extraordinary happened. The historian writes, when the steeple was added, one agile Lyman Woodard stood on his head in the belfry with his feet toward heaven. These days, nobody knows who Lyman Woodard was. There are no other stories about him, no other reports of curious behavior. All that exists is the story that once he stood on his head. This act was counter to New England practicality and prudence. It was a crazy, goofy thing to do, and it was curious enough to be written down in perpetuity in the local church's archives. But for anybody who has really received the Christian faith, this is not so curious at all. There's something about the faith we profess that is upside down. It begins in the history books of Israel. There are accounts of the younger son being chosen before the older brother. That's backwards. Or the last brother in line, the little one, the one who smells like sheep, being selected to rule over the others. Or the words of the prophet Micah, from you, O little town of Bethlehem, insignificant and almost forgotten, will come the Messiah. And when Jesus arrives, he continues the upside down nature of faith. In his stories, as in his teachings, the last become first and the first becomes last. The weak are strong, the powerful are pulled down from their thrones. And as the Apostle Paul reflects in the passage we heard to an early Christian group, the wisdom of God looks like foolishness to the world. The weakness of God is our strength. Now he's speaking specifically about the cross. Paul is aware the power of the cross is completely upside down to the average person who thinks about life being a series of advancements, flourishing, growing. He figures the average person may not know much about it. Now, I'm not sure what the people in Corinth actually knew about crucifixions themselves. The only crucifixions I've ever heard about were the ones in ancient Israel. The Roman Empire there executed those they deemed troublemakers in the most brutal and public way. They rounded up the thieves, the abusers, the insurrectionists. After roughing them up in broad daylight, they nailed them to wood and displayed them by the highways. The message was clear: don't let this happen to you. Because the empire thought they needed to do that in Israel. In the Greek city of Corinth across the Mediterranean, we don't know how many troublemakers actually ended up on crosses there. Corinth was a wealthy city, a seaport for global commerce, a crossroad for ideas. And it was cosmopolitan enough to generally be in sync with the rest of the empire. And here comes Paul, speaking of Jesus as the Savior of the world. And what is the evidence of his power? What strength does he reveal? He was put to death on a tree. That's upside down. Jesus does not come from the planet Krypton or Mount Olympus, strong and mighty with incredible powers. He's a first century woodcutter. He blended in so thoroughly, his own brothers thought he had lost his mind when he began to preach and heal. And it's true, he got his orders from somewhere else, but arguably any other Jew would have gotten the same orders if they paid attention to their own Bible. So what distinguishes Jesus, especially for Paul, is his death. Paul believes in the resurrection too. He has encountered the risen Christ. Yet when Paul speaks of death and resurrection, he frequently condenses the whole three-day Christian Passover by saying, "We preach Christ crucified," because that for him, and he suggests for us, is the power of God. It's worth wondering, how is this power? How is the cross the power of God? Maybe it only makes sense if you're standing on your head. Christians profess Jesus is the Savior of the world, that he's Son of God, but again, he was not born in a big city. His Nazareth parents were so poor they couldn't afford the lamb when they took him to the temple. In fact, they had to purchase a couple of old birds as an alternative. One of the first potential followers of Jesus made fun of his hometown. And then he died young, very young, in the most shameful way in his culture. How is this power? If he is indeed the Son of God, he intentionally has to hold back on his power. He couldn't show it all at once, not to mere mortals at least, because it would have blown the circuits and burned out the fuse box. Like God speaking to Moses, "If you were to see me face to face, you would be incinerated." So Christ holds back. As Paul says elsewhere, he empties himself. He chooses to be a servant. He gives himself for the life of the world. And he never comes to intimidate or compel, but to invite, to converse, to develop a relationship with us over time. And if we were to see who he is all at once, it would be too much. But when we do see who he is, it awakens us to the true shape of grace. Let me say it to you straight. We killed the Son of God. And God didn't kill us. That's the heart of the good news. Everything else is commentary. We crucified Jesus, and he didn't strike back. And when he came back, he didn't strike back. Which teaches us that justice is never about revenge or retaliation. Some might choose that path, but God refrains. in mercy. Now, a lot of people have had a lot of time to look at the cross and come up with an elaborate theory about what actually happened there, or what happened in God's heart and mind. A lot of speculation, mostly done by preachers who presume to know the heart and mind of God. One of the theories declares that God is furious with the world because of all its sins, so God demands payment for our trespassing on God's old turf. And seeing as no mere mortal could pay all the world's sin, God sends his only son to be the scapegoat, to bear the punishment that we deserve, just like an Old Testament sacrificial lamb, that Jesus takes our place, he gets what we deserve, and that after Jesus is killed, God is happy again. And I suppose if you sang the opening hymn we sang, it's there. And I also suppose if you grew up chewing on the book of Leviticus, you might also come to that same conclusion. But let me point out the obvious. We are the ones who put Jesus on the cross. People just like us, religious people, schemed, maneuvered, condemned, took up the hammer and nails. So others speculate the cross was God's will, that it happened because God wanted it to happen, or God allowed it to happen, or something like that. And true enough, the cross of Christ was the inevitable clash between heaven and earth. But to return to the heart of the gospel, heaven decided not to punish earth for its sin of sins. And I think this reveals to us that salvation comes not from an angry God who wants to balance the cosmic books by killing off his own son. Salvation comes from a God of mercy who chooses to forgive the very worst thing that we could ever do. This God decides punishment is not the way to win over a consistently clueless human race. This God sends Jesus back with scars to preach peace between enemies, to proclaim a wider inclusion of who actually belongs to God, and to invite those who trust this good news to now advance that mercy as the primary act of divine justice. The cross reveals the deep wisdom that God is not interested in obliteration. God's heart is all about search and rescue. That's the shape of grace. And I think it's best understood by those who really need the grace. Remember the stories of Jesus over and over again. Who are the ones who come to him? The little ones, like the children. And those who become like children again and again. Who else approaches him? The hurting ones, those with weary bones and broken hearts. Or the ones who are so weak that their friends must open a hole in the roof to lower them down. And don't forget who else comes. Those who are tainted, even possessed by evil and wish to be free. They come, they see Jesus, they find release. And conversely, who are the ones who miss out on Jesus? Those who take phone calls during sermons. Those who think they're in charge of the world. The powerful, the well-connected, the experts in religion who have God figured out and therefore dismissed. And don't forget who else misses out. That one poor man who was so rich and had many possessions that he couldn't unhook from it all to travel with Jesus. Here is the larger truth. God shows divine favor most clearly, not when we are strong, not when we are wise, but when we have the greatest need. The wisdom that the world dismisses as foolishness is there in that first and greatest beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit. Not the rich and famous, not the tall and suave, not the strong and self-assured, but those who actually need God. They are the ones who discover that God is on the cross and that God is now with them. That God is doing the ongoing work of saving them and the world. I've reached an age where I've begun to bury some of my friends. One of them will be remembered this afternoon in the funeral downtown. And of all the thousands of words offered in her memory, I mean, she's a preacher, and you got a bunch of preachers yammering about her. One of the elders of her church said it best. Virginia led us by never raising her voice. How humble, how Christ-like. Never needing to shout or dominate. But this morning I'm thinking of another preacher, Reverend Julie Ruth Harley. She was serving a church in suburban Chicago about 5 years ago when she was diagnosed with ALS, that fearsome disease that took her life eventually. The final sermon she ever preached was on Christmas Eve. She spoke from a wheelchair and she was thinking about Jesus. Listen. What are we to make of this God who comes to us swaddled and helpless, lying in a manger? Isn't this the last place we expect to find God? I thought about God in a new way during the last several weeks since I discovered I have Lou Gehrig's disease. My body is rapidly regressing. I am beginning to take on the characteristics of a small child. Why does God choose vulnerability rather than strength? Why does God choose dependence rather than autonomy? Why does God choose to come as a child who cannot walk or talk? I have come to the conclusion, she said, that the Word becomes flesh in a body like mine, which is so weak it must be rolled into this church in a wheelchair. I thought I was glorifying God when I was at the height of my physical powers, competing in a triathlon or hiking up a mountain. But maybe the true message is that God is glorified just as completely when I allow others to take care of me. Do you hear the mercy? She didn't have to be strong because she's saved by a Savior who is stronger than her, and the evidence of that Savior's strength is his vulnerability. This is a deep mystery, that the Savior of the world would be the one on the cross. Does that make any sense to you? I hope so. And if not, you may need to stand on your head.